Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Mean, joined by Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
So Brian's doing Brian stuff. He'll be back next week with, more Brian. So, you know, there's not enough Brian in this world. We need more Brian. So we'll get more Brian. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, I had one story, which I'll talk about in a moment. But, man, while we're getting ready to launch, didn't mean to use that term, but I found a story that relates that's kind of pretty awesome. You know, we talk a lot about SpaceX because, you know, SpaceX is doing really, really cool things. And then we talk about, you know, Blue Origin a little bit, Jeff Bezos's company, mm-hmm. which is, you know, kind of awesome too. Blue Origin's the one that did the new Shepard vehicle, which is a rocket that went up to the Kármán line and came back down. They haven't built anything that's gone orbital yet, but there are plans. They're building their new rocket, the new Glenn, named for John Glenn. New Shepard was Those rocket naming conventions come from Alan Shepard was the first American astronaut to go into space, which is when he went up, came back down. John Glenn, the first American astronaut to orbit the Earth. So their next rocket, which will be orbital class, is the new Glenn. They're in full development on this, which similar to SpaceX's like Falcon 9. They'll have two stages. They'll go up and go do this. They've built their own powerful rocket engines for this. They're also going to be building, you know, maybe building rocket engines for like, I think, ULA, whatnot. Very exciting stuff going on at Blue Origin. And SpaceX has been getting the news because they're kind of got the head start here, been, you know, or in the lead. But Blue Origin's not to be discounted, particularly when the richest man in the world is bankrolling this. Yeah. But there's another company, which we've talked a little bit about before, which there are other a lot of contenders, but they're the big contenders, the ones where you know money's not going to be a problem, that they're not going to run out of funding next year or whatever. The third contender we've talked about is Stratolaunch. Stratolaunch is the company started by Paul Allen. Paul Allen's one of the Microsoft billionaires. Paul Allen, who is a space enthusiast, science fiction enthusiast, among many things, you know, created that awesome museum in Washington. His company, Stratolaunch, came out with a very interesting approach, which was he said, we're going to go build like the largest airplane in the world, and we're going to use that as our launch platform. And the reason he wanted to use an airplane is that if you launch a rocket high enough, a high enough altitude, you can reduce the amount of fuel you need considerably. Now, the SpaceX approach and the Blue Origin approach is like, well, let's use a booster. Use the booster to take that upper stage pretty high, and then the upper stage can go take off. And then what Paul Allen wants to do is one of the first ways we actually tried launching our first vehicles to go into space were actually like, you know, the some of the experimental rocket planes, which were launched from other planes. So they've built this humongous plane we've seen before, which is this, you know, gigantic craft. And then it's not the technical name for it. But anyhow, the plan originally was when they first announced it, said, hey, we're going to make a deal with SpaceX. We're actually going to try to launch a Falcon 9. That fell apart because I think in part because SpaceX and maybe realized that logistically trying to build a Falcon 9 capable of launching from a space from an airplane maybe was a technical thing they didn't want to have to worry about at that point. So then they went on their own approach, figured out other things they're going to do, how they were going to, what vehicles they were going to launch, made agreements with other partners, et cetera. Well, today, Stratolaunch has announced, hey, and there have been rumors they've been working on their own vehicles. They announced they've a whole fleet of launch vehicles that they're going to be building. From what they have is they have existing vehicles like the Pegasus, which is a very small rocket, which is, you know, launched from a plane. They say they're going to be building a medium launch vehicle, their own rocket, which will be capable of carrying about 7,000 pounds. They expect the first flight in 2022. And then they want to have a medium launch vehicle heavy, which could do about 12,000, 13,000 pounds into, you know, which is not huge compared to what, say, like, you know, Falcon 9 does right now, but it's still really good for payloads, et cetera. It's still a really good launch vehicle for a lot of commercial applications. Mm-hmm. But then the rumor they'd been talking about, there was a rumor about something called black ice, that they were working on black ice, that it might be a space plane. They've confirmed that they are building their own space plane, which is basically Ooh. Something that looks like If you go to the website at Strata Launch, which is cool, you have to scroll up because, hey, space to see things. you can take a look at this very cool, looks like a an X-15 and a space shuttle had a baby.
Yeah, I can't tell if – are you talking about the one that it looks like – it would be a plane, but it has two main cabins instead of, you know, one fuselage, right?
That's the launcher. That's the vehicle that takes them up, and that's what they launch from.
Oh, wow. Okay, so then it's attached, I guess, in the center here, because they do have some other renderings. Like this one looks like a the shuttle, looks like the space shuttle.
Yeah, like in that. Yeah, it looks kind of like a next generation. It's got the heat tiles underneath and the white on top, but like two fins in the back, et cetera. So that is the space plane that they say that they're looking at this thing to be able to do medium class payloads and maybe crew, you know, and they're still in a design study. So, that's a far off thing. But at least they're coming out and saying, this is what we want to do. This is where we're trying to head.
So where is the timeline on stuff like this?
They list here, like, they don't have a timeline for that. Like, their own launch vehicle that they want to build for, like, the one that's going to start doing, like, the Pegasus, they're looking at 2020.
Yeah.
You know, so they're looking at the medium launch 2022, and then there aren't dates for the other ones.
Wow. So what are the advantages of a... you know, an aircraft launch versus like a rocket launch? I mean, I guess you save on having, you know, huge boosters and huge, fuel tanks, but
what you get out of this is that, now understand that Strata Launch first started, it was not clear at all that reusable boosters was going to work. That was a thing that we weren't clear that reusable boosters were going to work. And so this was a different bet. This was a bet that Paul Allen was making, that I think that we're better off using a spacecraft. I mean, you having a spacecraft launch from a ginormous high altitude airplane. Mm-hmm. And now we're realizing, well, you know, reusable boosters are a way to go. But the advantage with this is that you can aim this in any direction, and you can kind of put your payloads into many different kinds of orbits with, you know, your fuel requirements are, you know, less in some cases.
Yeah.
Because if you want to put something east-west, west-east, polar orbit, whatever, you don't have to launch this thing from you can launch rear rockets basically from runways. You don't have to go build, you know, or have to use, you know, Cape Canaveral or Vandenberg, whatever. Oh, yeah. So it increases the availability of places to launch from, mm-hmm. which is a big advantage. Cost-wise, your first stage, if it's an airplane, you're using, you know, Jet A, you're using airplane fuel for that, which means, well, the same way as like a booster works, but you're not using, you know, liquid oxygen and hydrogen or whatever. So you have an advantage there. Now, your rocket has to have more power than an upper stage of, let's say, like a SpaceX or Blue Origin rocket, because it's not getting as high.
Yeah.
But there are certain advantages to their rapid ability to, you know, launch. You know, you could probably put one of these things onto a hang in a on an airplane in a hangar and get this thing. Your launch readiness is faster. So there are certain advantages to this, you know, and you have a payload limit, though, you know, to it.
Sure.
And, you know, their timeline, you know, 2022 for their medium launch, that's going to be around the time that we're hoping, best case scenarios, the Big Falcon rocket, which is SpaceX's next vehicle, which they're building, which will be the fully reusable monster, you know, starts flying. But, you know, I think more bets are better.
Well, and I think that's when we talk about how radically different space is going to be in the future, that's really what we're talking about. If you want to get mm-hmm. into nuts and bolts, is not only the trajectory of the companies that are flying now, but assuming that they progress and there are new players, because any space that has the financial capability that exploring an entirely new frontier, specifically one that is as, you know, the possibilities are kind of endless, like what space is, will have people following now that there's a blueprint of how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's there's going to be, if let's assume that SpaceX is successful with the Big Falcon rocket and they're able to hit that $7 million, $10 million range for what they want to say it'll cost to launch, which is ridiculously cheap. I mean, that's like hiring a commercial airplane, you know, to fly around your friends around the world is, you know, that's approaching that cost right there. But let's say that's successful. you're still looking at $7 to $10 million every time you want to launch the BFR, which in today's space age is super, super cheap. But if you're trying to do experiments or satellite payloads, whatever, that still can be expensive for what could be capable. And what Stratolaunch is going to be able to offer in theory is even cheaper, much, much, much cheaper with cheaper vehicles. And these things might be a fully expendable rocket, might be $1 million, but you can put your payload into orbit. So there's going to be opportunities out there that SpaceX are going to say, that's not, you know, we're not going to try to go after that market because it's not a part that we want to go after. And where Stratolaunch can say, hey, we can do these smaller payloads. There's a lot of military stuff too. That's one of the things that whenever you read a proposal for anything that's proposed about space, launching space, it is a message, one, to people who are launching satellites currently, you know, telecommunications companies, et cetera, governments and military. And they're often these requirements are very specific to what military payloads may need. And I've seen that a lot with some of the SpaceX stuff. You'll hear them, we're going to be able to do this. Then you'll read like Air Force is talking about looking for something that can do X, and you find out, well, SpaceX has clearly positioned themselves to do that. Same with Blue Origin. Mm-hmm. Wow. Exciting times.
Yeah. So, oh yeah. Space plane. Totally.
Space plane.
And also I'm excited that we can talk about, other, not only another company, but also just a full other way to interact with space.
Right. A completely different mechanism to send payloads up.
Yeah. I don't know how useful this will be for much larger payloads. I don't know, but I know that they're really smart people working at Stratolaunch, and they've got a very smart guy who's backing them. And yeah. I'm encouraged, you know, and it's like Blue Origin. It's like, you know, I wear my SpaceX t-shirts almost every day, but I'm, you know, I want Blue Origin succeed. You know, I want these visionaries to build a bigger future. You know, it's, I live in a world where Google, Apple, you know, Netflix, they all won and it worked out, and, you know, Android and stuff. And it worked out pretty cool from where I'm looking.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. No, without a doubt. Yeah. And that's what's fascinating. If you project a couple years out, is like, okay, well, yeah, there's definitely a cap of what they can get up into orbit, but like size wise, but also it's like, well, how many things below that cap are going to be going up into orbit? Like, I think we're going to be looking at a lot of stuff that's, you know, this is going to be a far busier space in 5 years than it was 5 years ago.
Which brings me to my next story.
Okay.
What thing we were talking, I was going to talk about before, but this timed with that really well.
Well, actually, I'll tell you what, before we get into that, let's also remind people that you can back this show at patreon.com/weirdthings. Again, patreon.com/weirdthings. Make sure that you keep this show rocking and rolling by heading on over there right now, kicking in a few dollars. You get your own RSS feed, get to the After Things show quicker than you would otherwise. So, please, thank you for doing it if you've already done it, and please consider doing it if you haven't yet. Thank you. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
So George Dvorsky over at Gizmodo has made a declaration. He says, hey, artists, stop putting shiny crap into space. Now, remember we talked about the orbital there was the mirror ball, which was launched by, I think, Rocket Lab. They put that into orbit to show, hey, we can put things into orbit now, too, which, you know, people were critical of this. They had the Humanity Star, which orbited, then finally deorbited. And there were some criticisms of it. And, you know, and people said, hey, it could interfere with astronomical observations. I'm not aware that it actually did. But there was this, it's going to interfere with astronomy. Like, maybe it will. I don't know, but I don't know that it did. I thought it was, I wasn't exactly thinking that it was the most inspired stunt, but I understand exactly why Rocket Lab did it. Was people knew who a Rocket Lab was, and they knew that they could put things into orbit. So it was a brilliant kind of move, was like, we're upset that you're doing this thing. And they had certain scientists and astronomers were very upset by this because, like, hey, you're putting this thing into space and it can interfere.
When the Rocket Lab one went up, I did not know that it was being done by another rocket company. I just thought this was some dude sending this kind of dumb statement up.
Yeah. Well, and that's sort of kind of how some part of the people in the media handled it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Gizmodo had covered that before, and they talked about it, and they had, you know, an astrophysicist, the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. You know, Jonathan McDowell said, it's the space equivalent of somebody put a neon advertising billboard right outside your bedroom window.
I mean,
I mean, your bedroom window?
It's very tiny. It's a very tiny neon sign.
And I don't know that it interfered with anything, and I didn't hear a lot of follow-up saying that it did. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't, but the people who were upset that this was going to happen seemed to have dropped the story after it came back down without finding out if it did cause problems. And that was something like, well, I don't know. But anyhow, we've got a new art installation project, and this is the Orbital Reflector, the brainchild of U.S. artist Trevor Paglen. And basically what it is, it's going to go up on a CubeSat, and once it's unfurled and fully erect, the space-based sculpture will be visible in the night sky, appearing as a fast-moving bright star. It will stay in low Earth orbit for a minimum of 60 days, though it could be longer. Yeah, it might be like 72 days. It's low Earth orbit. It's in a degrading orbit, unless the laws of physics radically change. Well, you know, I'm sure it's not going to stay up there. But Dvorsky is very upset about this, says that we need to stop putting shiny stuff into space, and talk to some other astronomers who totally agree. And, you know, it is a cause for concern among many people of, you know, these artists putting these shiny objects into space. And this is done as part of an art project at the Nevada Museum of Art.
I mean, I guess it's an issue of scale, right? Like, if there were one of these every year, it would be not an issue. But if we extrapolate into a world where, you know, it becomes cheaper and cheaper to put stuff into space, then from a scientific point of view, this would mostly just be space junk.
Well, okay. Let's dial it back a little bit.
Okay.
So in a world where we were not interacting with space as often as we are, how would we view this? Because I have a feeling that my sense is that we would view this as, oh, eccentric artist does big eccentric artist thing. Mm-hmm. And sure, there would be some people that don't like it or think it's unnecessary, and certainly many more that might think it's wasteful, but that's kind of, baseline criticisms of art, right? As long as it's not doing any harm, I don't know how many people would be mad at it if it weren't if space weren't more of a reality for us. Now that it is, and things like space junk, and even, you know, for whatever it's worth, you know, Space Force is something that we talk about. These are just realities on levels that they hadn't been previously. I wonder, you know, where this kind of griping, A, is coming from, and B, who's listening to this and saying, yes, none of this stuff. Because if it was really hurting something, then that would kind of be the headline, right?
I'll give you the closing paragraph, which is from Dvorsky. It's getting easier and cheaper to put objects into orbit, which explains why artists are now using space as their canvas. Rocket companies like SpaceX, Spaceflight Industries, and Rocket Lab stand to profit from ferrying many satellites to orbit, which means they have little incentive to question such endeavors. Given this new era of access, government agencies may need to determine new standards for what gets to go into space and what doesn't. On its own, Paglen's orbital reflector won't pose a problem, but given that it's the second flashy sculpture to go into orbit this year, we may soon see a lot more of these projects. Maintaining a clean, unhindered low Earth orbit and upholding the needs of science should take precedence over gestures as these. So let me unpack this just a little bit. Low Earth orbit is a very, very large area that goes from basically, you know, arguably, you know, the lowest point of orbital line is actually debatable, but we'll put it at, you know, 100 miles to about 1,000 or 2,000 miles up. There are many different orbital paths there. CubeSats go into this super low area there, and they can only orbit for a certain amount of time because drag slows them down and they deorbit and they break up in the atmosphere, okay? There's that area of LEO, low Earth orbit, and that's where CubeSats generally are launched from. So it's this treating it like there's this one highway, like, oh, well, you know, there's all, you know, we can't put too many things up. It's like, yeah, it's more complicated than that. But things do get into paths of other things. Higher orbit, the further up you get into LEO, the more desirable it can be because you can be more there much more stably, have a more stable orbit. Lower the orbits are kind of generally less desirable if you want a long term orbit because it's harder. You need to have your, you know, what's called station keeping. You have to keep fueling the thing, keep moving it. But that's sort of the thing, like, okay, you're saying low Earth orbit, but like it's kind of like saying the ocean. Like, yeah, we don't want to pollute the ocean, but if somebody wants to put a boat out in the ocean for a while, is that a problem? Well, here they're saying it could be a problem to astronomers. We've heard astronomers go, this could be a problem. we haven't heard an astronomer say this one was a problem. Will we get to a point where putting shiny things into space could be a problem for astronomy? Very much could be. It already is a case where, you know, if you're an astronomer, you know, you got to keep track of the ISS and other shiny objects. There are thousands of satellites up there that do reflect light, and if you know where to look, you see them. In the case of this, you know, it's one more object, but it's for a purpose we don't agree with. And that's the thing that, like, I'm not a big fan of art, installation art, and in-your-face art. I'm not a big fan of a lot of this stuff because I think it's kind of BS. I'm not necessarily a fan of this thing. But I'm not going to tell them, hey, you don't have a right to do this. I'm not going to say, hey, listen, I've decided my science is more important than your art, therefore you can't do your art. And that's the problem I have here is that I might feel that, hey, like if, you know, if somebody's doing critical medical technologies, things like this, and it's interfering, I'm like, yeah, maybe not a good idea. Somebody's making astronomical observations. Those are useful and those are of value to people. But do I have the authority to say, hey, enough of this art crap?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what it comes down to.
My take is, if this is something that is interfering with big stuff, then I think, you know, it's funny because, you know, and this gets into a whole nother conversation, but the solution is governments are going to need to decide what can go up into space instead of, I think it's going to be these companies that are deciding,
yeah,
like, okay, like, we're not going to put these things up. Like, this, my sense is that they will continue to send things up as it, you know, as people are paying for these rockets to have them go up. But it's not going to be, I mean, I can't just go up there and say, oh, no, send my space weapon up. Like, they're going to say no, but that violates a, you know, law. So we can't, they're not just gun runners, right? And so maybe that will extend to large, potentially dangerous or hazardous or distracting art installations. But I don't know if we're there yet.
Well, yeah, and I think that, you know, the Dvorsky sort of thing is, you know, the comment there is like, well, you know, SpaceX and them, they're, you know, it's money. They want to make a buck. It's like, well, they're partners with companies like NASA and other people who are involved in space research. I think they're going to be a little more mindful than, you got $1,000. Ah, pay me in bills, put in a shopping bag. I'll put it into orbit. You know, like, and there may be, there will be cases where maybe struggling space launch companies may want to do those things, but I think that he just sort of cavalierly sort of was like, well, they don't care. I'm like, no, I think they care. They're more invested in this than you are and more invested than some of the people complaining who have yet to demonstrate this has affected them. And I'm super pro science. I'm super, super, super pro science. But I don't want to get in a position where I'm saying, therefore, my love of discovering things about far off parts of, you know, our galaxy are more important than your art. You know, I won't make that, you know, I won't make that call.
Sure.
You know, and say, therefore, you can't do this thing.
Yeah. And like, you know, all these companies are on the razor's edge of being something that will be regulated more by world governments. Like, yeah. So that's something that they're definitely going to have. they're going to understand the line. And I would assume that they will be proactive about enforcing that line as they go forward, because the last thing they want is another level of governmental bureaucracy, let alone some kind of level of international government bureaucracy about clearing everything they send into space.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's I think the value of this, like, right now is really cool. I think the value of this is pretty awesome in that, you know, it's neat now. And yeah, I think that in a few years' time, it will become crass. And as you start doing more stuff like this, it'll be like, all right, do we really need to do this? It's been done. You know, there was, remember the Christo, the artist, you know who I'm talking about? Used to do the...
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, Christo. So Christo and... and I guess is in Jean-Claude. So he was the guy that, like, entirely wrapped an island in plastic, right? Did these really, really, really cool things of, like, creating these huge art pieces, taking existing things and then wrapping them and doing this sort of things. And what he first did them was kind of amazing. You'd see these, oh, it's this, I'm confused. Christo and Jean-Claude.
So it is, and again, I remember the name Christo and ignoring that it's a partnership here. So they've like wrapped the Reichstag. They've done some really cool stuff. They did a 24-mile long thing called the Running Fence in Sonoma and whatnot. But there's been, and Jean-Claude died in 2009. There have been criticisms, growing criticisms of like doing this landscape artwork that like when it first was done, it's kind of cool, but then it's like, all right, we know it's temporary. We know you're making a statement, but really, do we want to throw a bunch of plastic out there in this environment? Do we really want to do that? And again, these things are cleaned up and they're done, but that criticism kind of comes up after a point of like, do we want to keep doing these kinds of things?
I mean, the question for me is like specific damage, right? Like if this stuff gets cleaned up or recycled or reused, like that seems fine, you know? And so I guess that's kind of how I'm approaching the orbital reflector is like, mm-hmm. you know, if it's not leaving this big plastic bag up in space as junk, then I don't know. It will be another blip in the sky for, what, two and a half months?
Yeah, and well, the argument is made is that for astronomers who are trying to do their, you know, trying to make
make observations.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I'm reading the book by Timothy Wu, which is about the master switch, and they talk about how AT&T was able to prevent anybody from doing anything relating to telephones because they could say, well, there's the threat that you could electrocute technicians working a line if you put your own telephone on there, or if even you put a plastic device on your phone. It's a threat to the system, which could kill people, and they use that threat to suppress anything that, you know, any other telephone technologies because they had a government-backed monopoly. You had the same thing going on with, you know, Sarnoff and AM radio. As they suppressed FM radio, they got the government to, you know, prevent the development of FM radio because they realized that FM was a threat to AM stations because, you know, they had a control over AM and you could have other. So it was, you know, these threats only sort of materialize and become real once you get the government to back you and say, yeah, no, we agree with this sort of threat. And that's the thing here. It's like we're hearing what can interfere with astronomy, And is it a territorial thing? Like, hey, space is for us space people and science-y people and not art. Is it for people doing real legitimate stuff or not? I would love it instead that he was launching a space telescope. Yeah. I'd love this, but I'm not going to be here and be like, you're there for your crap. Can't do it, you know? So,
yeah.
Anyhow, I've got to run in a few minutes, but I've got a question for you guys.
Okay.
Shoot.
Do you want to buy a hat?
Are we buying a hat from you, Andrew?
Are you going to be a merchant of fine chapeaux?
I've got a hat. I'm representing somebody. I'm going to try to sell this to you.
Okay. What style of hat is it?
If anybody wants to buy this hat, I got an auction going here. It's a fur hat. It's kind of like one of these Russian, you know, sort of hat.
Not a Jamiroquai.
Probably not. I don't know what that means, but I'm going to say.
Oh, no. Just Google. You remember Jamiroquai?
I remember him. I just remember the hat. I just, you know.
He wore a hat. He was a big old furry.
He was known
top
for his big furry hat.
Okay, it's great. Glad that this
so,
is right, legacy.
So not a Jamiroquai, just more of like a kind of like a Russian or Chinese fur hat.
Like a fur hat. Okay. Yeah. Well, all right. Is this was this hat owned by someone famous?
Okay. And you guys are not bidding together. You're competing against each other. Okay.
So. Well, number one, I'm going to start the bidding at $5.
Ooh,
because Andrew has already purchased for me a fur hat and it was great. So I am a satisfied customer and I would like to buy another one. I'm in the market for another fur hat as sold by Andrew Main. I'm in. Bidding begins at $5. Well, Finsky, if you will.
I'm going to hear your five-star review. And I'm going to say $6, Justin. How about that?
More of a beanie. It's more of a beanie. So actually, I think Justin will look great for you in Oakland.
Okay. A fur beanie.
Oh, okay.
Fur beanie sounds like the main character on a children's show.
I'm gonna send you guys a photo of this hat.
Go ahead.
Sure.
I'm waiting.
Justin's at $5. What will you give me for this price?
Oh, I'll go up as far as $10. I mean, a fur beanie. God.
For the record, he already offered six, and now he's just trying to gouge me because he knows that I love these fur beanie idea. But
wait,
you want to know what
till
I was
you
undeterred.
See this one. Wait till you see this one.
Okay.
I'm in for $25. Eat that, Nesh.
I'm going to say, I mean, 25. We're starting to get a little.
I'm going
to
tell you something, too.
I'll say 35.
It's one of a kind.
One of a kind? Make it 36. All right, so you've just texted us an image of the hat.
It's going to come with a certificate of authenticity.
Who is this gentleman? This looks like a sim.
The seller of the hat.
Oh, my God. Is this a beanie of his own hair?
No.
Is this a beanie of someone else's hair?
All right, so just so everybody knows, I'm looking now at this man. He is a pale gentleman, an older gentleman. He's wearing this beanie. He looks bald because the beanie looks fairly form-fitting to his skull. Mm-hmm. But and this is a picture taken of a screen. It looks like very natural fiber.
I don't – it's a one-of-a-kind. Am I supposed to know this – gentleman, Andrew?
What would make you want to buy this? What would make you want to buy this hat?
I mean, he looks very creepy. So there's a chance that this is something that I can maybe resell into the macabre marketplace. Yeah. Or
on Scary
I mean,
Etsy.
There is a dark secret to this hat. I think we can all agree on that central premise, right?
For sure. If I was going to buy, what I would need
as far
this
as we
hat,
know, there is this man a has deep not done dark. Anything creepy.
Okay, well, I would need to know that the fur of this fur beanie is like a next tier, at a medium tier or higher animal's fur, right? Like not chinchilla, not rabbit, like something higher than that.
Higher, like give me an example of higher than that.
Like... maybe mink or something rare, right? Like a rare furred animal, an Arctic fox. Though it's the fur
rarer than that.
Well, it's brown. It's like brown with some dark spots. So it's probably not an Arctic creature.
No, maybe not. I don't know.
I don't know, Justin. What do you think? Is a brown furred animal?
It's gonna be something famous or personal. That's my bet. Like he killed the last badger known to man and made a beanie out of its fur, or if this is like his family dog that he's like, I need to remember. Spot checkers and so now I'm gonna wear my spot checkers hat because I knitted a hat of its fur.
It's the spot checkers hat that does not have spots or checkers on it.
No. Not a well named dog.
maybe like a famous bear, like a famous circus animal.
Is that interesting?
Is that getting warmer, colder?
Interesting.
BioCow suggests maybe it's chupacabra hair. Is this guy trying to sell a
interesting
a chupacabra?
Oh,
beanie?
A cryptid hair.
I'm gonna say that we don't doubt the existence of this creature.
Well, we okay.
Well, we're pretty permissive,
right? Like we've found things that we can call the chupacabra before. Is it goblins? Is this goblin hair? Could it be goblins?
I'm going to say science does not doubt the existence of the source of hair.
No, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, could this be dog hair from a dog that looks like a tiger?
No. I'm going to give you another hint.
Okay.
This article came from the Siberian Times.
Oh, from Siberia. Oh. Yeah. Okay, so then maybe it is an Arctic animal. What do they have up there? I mean, we know they have bears. That's a big thing, right? Russians and bears. But J.C. Calhoun says maybe it's a wolf. Is it a wolf?
Mm-hmm. Nope. And we assume that this guy, there's we assume that he's the authenticity of the material. We're not, nobody's super skeptical of it. Pretty like it's very likely that this is what it is. He says it is. Are you ready for what this is?
Okay.
You ready for this?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's an extinct animal.
Okay.
Woolly mammoth.
No.
So, you know, they find these mammoths like in Siberia periodically, and their entire area is like their mammoth hair is something you can actually buy. So this guy, his story is, my relative went to a woolly mammoth grave. This is Vladimir Amosov, a 44, a builder from Yatusk, says, my relative went to a woolly mammoth graveyard site at Kazakia Village in Ust-Yanisky and Yakutia. He picked up a full plastic bag of woolly mammoth hair and later sold it to me because he needed money. I kept looking at the bag, wondering what to do with the hair, then thought, why not try to make a hat? In Yakutia, we make traditional round hats of horsehair, so why not try and use mammoth hair and create something truly unique? He hired a specialist hat maker to crochet the hat in Yakutian style. He also verified to Samoy Gagarev, director of Yakutia's Mammoth Museum, that this was indeed authentic hair from the extinct beast.
Oh my goodness.
So this is for real?
For real.
Oh, so I'm looking at another photo from the Siberian Times. This doesn't even look like a very good hat. This looks scratchy and
I'm so looking at you, old Christian green. Dior over here. you know, with all the experience of making hats out of the fur of extinct animals.
I'm just saying it's an unappealing product photo that they've
oh, pulled. I'm sorry, Tommy Hilfiger. I'm sure that this poor Siberian farmer person really is going to be stung by your fashion criticism of the fact that he took woolly mammoth hair and made a hat out of it.
Okay, so you get a certificate of authenticity also to guarantee that it is real woolly mammoth fur.
Yeah, you can hang it from the hat like mini pearl from, you know, that way people, if they want to know, like, is it a new hat? Like, it's a new hat. Well, it's
actually it's all fun and games until Kanye is stepping out in it. Right.
So,
I mean, like, we've come to a point where all fashion is commoditized and everything can be knocked off in a Chinese factory so quickly. Yeah. We need to define tiers of luxury. And I feel like this is it. Let's plant our flag here. Let's make a deal with what's homeboy's first name again?
His first name is
Vladimir. Oh.
Vladimir. Yeah. Let's go. Let's get Vlad on the horn. Let's talk turkey. This is going to be a big deal. We want to get this in the hands of influencers and celebrities. There's going to be all these YouTube kids telling fam to smash the subscribe button and ring that bell in their new woolly mammoth hat. Everyone's gonna want one.
So I just,
this is big deal.
I just saw the price tag on this, Andrew.
Yeah,
Andrew. This is I put up $36 American for this hat.
Well, but it's going for $10,000.
It's going for $10,000.
Yeah, you know, right now, Pharrell is probably looking at his Bitcoin count, whatever, and going like, you know, yeah, I'll wear that.
Yeah,
that'll make some headlines.
He can put this on the big hat. He can have a hat for the big hat.
Oh, my God. It would be a literal hat on a hat.
A hat on a hat. And it's like the same. Yeah, it would match, too. Wow.
Yeah, remember the Brady Bunch house got sold? And I think this is only a matter of time. This is one news item away, you know, from, you know, the one Instagram feed from somebody, you know, saying, hey, check out.
Number one, you have to assume that either Nicolas Cage has made an offer to buy it or he has had a fight with his financial advisor about buying.
Yeah.
Right. Like, this is something that Nick Cage, this has Nick Cage written all over it.
So is it legal to take the hair of a woolly mammoth? Are they protected extinct?
I think that you can buy the stuff because, well, they're not protected, Bryce. They're dead. it didn't work. The Neanderthal Protection League.
Well, I guess so.
Wow.
No use mammoth for hair and head. Hey, gentlemen, I've got to run. It's okay. Been a pleasure, and I'll let you continue your bidding war over this hat.
Sure, we'll go do picks while you go off to your all your weird things meetings.
Yeah, my pick is go see Mission Impossible Fallout. Bye.
Okay, bye. Okay.
Bye. Bryce?
What's up, Justin?
You got any picks?
I have a pick. I just Netflix does this thing where it comes out with a show and it really wants you to watch that show. And so it only shows you that show at the top of your feed for two weeks.
They do lean in, right?
Yeah. But you know, I try to end up watching a lot of different things because, you know, I'm on Cord Killers and we try to talk about new stuff. So I ended up last night taking a look at the first episode of Afflicted. Have you seen the advertisement for Afflicted?
Afflicted.
Afflicted. It's
no,
a,
I am unaware of what Afflicted is.
It's a docu-series following seven people who have chronic illnesses that we don't always have a scientific basis to believe are real or illnesses that we don't have any way to diagnose or have a name for what these people have. So
I feel like this was a genre of programming that I knew existed. I don't know if it still is going on, but it seemed like it was the proto true crime. Like it was
like weird illnesses.
I remember watching, getting like sucked into it one day where it was like My Mystery Illness. And it was like one of those like Discovery ID or channels that now almost exclusively talk about murders.
Yeah.
Right?
Like extended cable, you know, oddities
exactly.
of the body. Yeah.
But they were like fairly cheaply made like a docuseries where it was primarily interviews with the person who was dealing with it. And then maybe somebody in their extended family, a few doctors, but it would all be built around like, so I started vomiting through my ears. So I went to a doctor and the first doctor said I was pregnant and I wasn't. And then I went to another doctor and then we did these surgeries and then nothing changed. And I kept vomiting.
Mm-hmm.
Your third act kind of revelation that it turns out that there's a goblin in my skull that's sick. And so we removed it by taking vitamin B, and that was it. So like that was like a genre of programming, but now you're saying it's back in Netflix form.
Well, and it's the way it's set up is that, you know, those shows were either like following one person for a very long, like the show was about one person, or it would be like illness of the week, right? Like here's a very brief story, and this one is like. I guess it's kind of like that, but it is talking about these seven people who have these seven different diseases over seven episodes. So they all have these slightly longer arcs, right? Like there's a woman on the first episode that they introduce who has electromagnetic sensitivity, the same thing that Chuck has on Better Call Saul. And it starts with like that the show starts with like her talking to the camera crew outside of her house of like, okay, these are the ground rules of my house. You need to keep your cell phones in your car and turned off. We have to limit wireless audio, this, that, and the other thing. It seems like her arc is going to be about wanting to move to the National Radio Quiet Zone in West Virginia where they don't have cell towers or any wireless signals so that she can live without, you know, the pain of living with electromagnetic sensitivity.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, I think on one of those shows, that would be maybe too much for an episode of the week, but an illness of the week.
Yeah, because it's not just about trying, because like that, the show that I was talking about would be more like I kept passing out. And so I got diagnosed for low blood pressure and then that didn't do anything. And then they thought that I was having a stroke and that didn't do anything. And then she finds out the end of that episode is, or that show is, and I have electromagnetic sensitivity, but this is no. I have a debilitating disease. I'm a human.
And I,
how
have
do
a
I live with
journey.
It?
Yeah. Right. And I think that's what separates it is that it is rather artfully well put together. And it also, you know, the first episode does not really pull punches of like getting interviews with internists and doctors to say, well, we don't really have any way to prove that electromagnetic sensitivity is a real thing. We don't have a name for this chronic fatigue syndrome that this young boy has. This experimental treatment that this one woman is going for to deal with her acute sensitivity to fungus has never been shown to work for any scientific purpose at all. It is very upfront with like, hey, let's not get too crazy with saying that this is a thing that you, the viewer, may also have.
Let's not get too crazy and understand that some of these people just might be crazy.
And I think that's like enough of a netting to say, oh, I can empathize with you and believe you that you are having an issue, even if maybe it's not this exact thing, or if it's this thing that we don't understand. You know, one of the young men in the first episode is, you know, he over this period of 6 months just came over this chronic fatigue syndrome where, you know, slowly his entire body just became increasingly weak to light and sound and movement and his muscles. And so he spent, you know, 2 years in his bedroom with you know, a caretaker and his mother, because it hurts to do anything. I think that there are ways that that could be fake, but I also think that there are ways that it's a very real thing, and it's a thing that we might not understand about the human body or the human, you know, central nervous system or what have you. But they're very story focused, and I don't know. I'm excited to look into the other six episodes of this, because I don't know how you finish telling these stories. These people, I'm sure, are not cured in any way.
Well, I think that's the fascinating part of it, is that there is a very human element to any kind of conversation that you might have with friends or family, where it doesn't even have to be medical, right? It can just be a thing that they're going through, or an explanation for something that's in their lives. And to a certain extent, you have a responsibility to say, okay, well, is this real, or are you just kind of being weird, right? Mm-hmm. But then after a certain point, there's a very human, relatable, almost universal kind of moment where you're like, well, look, in my heart of hearts, I don't have to believe it, but this is just what it is for them. And these are the most extreme outer cases of those situations where now, like, medically, you're like, okay, well, I guess we're trying to prove that you're not a liar, but also you're obviously in pain. So there's probably something wrong. So whatever. Yeah, if you need to be in a woodland in West Virginia, then let's just do it.
Yeah, and you know, I in just Googling to find the IMDb page for Afflicted, like, the other sort of issue with this story being on this platform is that, like, these people have lives, and some of them are on social media, and so, like, there's some Medium post, the truth behind Netflix's Afflicted, you know, whether that's just, you know, the documentary subject feeling like they were not portrayed right, or were told one thing and were shown the other thing. Wow, this actually looks like it might be a lot of the people who are on the show. You know, that's also another facet of it, is like, well, what even is the real story, or a different story? And how does that intersect with, well, you know, if there's a weird unspoken trust element that it's hard to call it trust, because they don't need me to trust them, and I don't need them to trust me necessarily.
Yeah,
but it's an interesting thing to say, we're going to make a documentary about things that doctors don't always even believe exists.
Well, but that's also just that there's a persistent question in the documentary that does not have to be ginned up, that doesn't have to be produced, quote unquote, right, to make sure that there's a conflict. Because no matter what, you can make it about, will Betty get to the McDonald's without puking because she has an allergy to red? And that can be where you end your story. But no matter what, the audience is not only wondering whether or not she'll do it, but they're wondering whether or not she's faking. And we're watching these people, even if we do have sympathy for them, we're kind of still watching them and saying, but if she were a liar, how would she act?
Right. Or you can get someone who is, overly confident and says, that's just this other thing. You just need to go do
exactly
this other thing.
That's just lupus.
Yeah. Right. Which, these people do go to see doctors and they are, have tried to get prognoses. It's an interesting conversation. And I just sort of fell into it less than 24 hours ago. So,
well, and that is another thing is, and so much of medicine and dealing with doctors is just grasping for straws in the dark, even, but we think of it as, like programming, or like, oh, okay, well, I can just edit this code and then hit publish and there we go. Now we're fixed. But it's like medicine is still,
it's still like,
could be this,
right?
Could be this other thing.
Yeah.
And so there are probably more of these cases than we realize, but we don't think about it. Cause by and large, if you're able bodied, then you kind of think like, oh no, I get sick. I take a pill. I get better. Yeah. Boom. How hard is it?
And I think, one last facet of this is, the woman who was introduced as having electromagnetic sensitivity, she's showing, everyone around the house and the various things that they do to, accommodate for her condition. And she has plugged into these walls, I don't remember the exact name, but the like dirty electricity cleaners, basically. And I had never heard of that. The idea of like dirty electricity is a weird, you would have heard about it if this was a thing. Apparently the issue of like, oh, well, the electrical current coming to your house is not a perfect sine wave. And so you plug this into your wall and it cleans up the distortion and corruption. And so I was trying to Google it and find out what this was. And it seems like there are plenty of cottage industries waiting to enable and profit off of, these people's,
oh my God,
body or bodily reactions to these things. And like, it was very difficult for me to find like something that wasn't trying to sell me something to clean the dirty electricity or to,
like you can't look and find a thing like, here's the scientific explanation of dirty energy. It's always like, here's the scientific explanation and buy link, and purchase link.
Or nowadays with the way SEO massaging is, it's like blogs or things that look like realistic scientific things saying, oh, well, dirty electricity is believed to be a thing, and you're reading it and it looks semi-official, but you're skeptical, and then you see like a misspelling in all this text and you're like, okay, so this is definitely probably not real at all. There are outside forces trying to enable and amplify and profit off of these people's plight. And that all folds into this.
So, absolutely.
That's afflicted. What do you got, Justin?
Man, nothing as cool as that. my continuing research into the 1960 election has brought me to the seminal work of that era. It is often referred to in pretty much everything else that I've read about it. It is Theodore White's The Making of the President. I am blown away that this does not have an audiobook because the prose is so floral.
Yeah.
And it would be something that would be amazing to be read by the right person. But look, it is very significant for a couple of reasons. Number one, Theodore White had tremendous access to the Kennedy campaign. It is significant in that not only do you kind of get a view from the inside, but also that it was very much historically, it is pointed to as a moment when, maybe the press got too close to a politician, right? And how much narrative not only means in politics now, but meant specifically for the Kennedys when we talk about Camelot and how much the Kennedy family to this day. I mean, remember the one of the answers to the State of the Union last year or this year, I forget, I guess it was this year, was a Kennedy, right? Like that's how much this family still means to America. But there's just such an amazing, also this was the first book that was in that genre that also still goes today of the, this was the story of the campaign books. Those didn't exist until the making of the president.
Right.
And then he did three more after that. But that whole genre was invented by this book. And it shows you kind of how it's evolved because, again, the prose here, just out of this world. Like it is a writer's book in that, you know, the epilogue talks about in such rapturous terms how America elects its president and how it wakes up early in the small town of New Hampshire where they vote at midnight. And then it gets very democratic on the East Coast. But then the conservative swell begins as the Midwest and West begin to report their precincts and how much that this is not really a dramatic occasion because at the end of the day, we know theoretically the results are known to our collective intelligence. But because of time zones, we have this back and forth seemingly. There's stuff that I wish I actually had my Kindle with me so I could just read back some of the great lines. But my favorite, which I'm going to butcher, is that there has never been a direct democracy as chaotic as America's that has worked as well as America's. That most of Western Europe and the settled parts of America. And by the way, there are a lot of things in this book that it's like, man, it's written in 1960. We've grown a lot since then. But that there's no direct democracy like America, and that America's has proven, though chaotic, to be very effective. In fact, he points out that there has been only one country that has tried to mimic the direct election of a leader like America, modeling on our system, that was Weimar Republic of Germany, and they got Hitler from it. And we got Lincoln. That is like a pairing of sentences, is they got a Hitler, we got Lincoln. And so it is very much a story told from a very pro-American point of view for our international listeners, but it is fairly amazing. I'm still reading it now, but it is worth it if you are a history nerd, without a doubt. So, The Making of the President by Theodore White.
And this is the 1960 book.
This is the 1960. This is the OG. It wound up becoming, much like episode, Star Wars eventually became episode 4, A New Hope. This was the original The Making of the President, and then He did, I think, three or four more successive in that. As that one became very popular, he wound up doing more. I've only read about a quarter of the first one.
Very cool. Well, for Andrew Main and Brian Rushwood, who are both not here, and for Justin Robert Young, it's been good getting weird with you guys. And it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.